This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the extraordinary twists and turns of the Syria crisis. Also, does the New York election signal a repudiation of Mayor Mike Bloomberg?
Policing policies that single out young people of color. That isn't a New York we can allow to continue.
I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, The Onion, it turns 25. Is it getting funnier with age or becoming a little sanctimonious? Then we'll explore how the internet has changed what it means to be popular. And then Salinger, a new documentary that has everyone talking about the 20th century's most reclusive author.
Getting a letter from J.D. Salinger was like getting a letter from Holden Caulfield, but written just to me.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. An extraordinary week in the Syria crisis, as an accidental proposal by John Kerry turns into a major Russian initiative. Could this be a lucky break for the world and for President Obama? Then, New York Democrats chose the most liberal and anti-Bloomberg candidate in their primary election this week, setting up a radical change in how the city is governed. Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
It's very hard to keep track of the twists and turns in the Syria crisis. So over the past week, we've gone from President Obama desperately trying to get congressional approval with a diminishing sense of that being possible to an off-the-cuff remark by Secretary of State John Kerry being transformed by Vladimir Putin and his evil minions into a genuine potential way out of the Syria standoff, with the idea being that Syria would hand over its chemical weapons to Russia, which would destroy them, and Syria would sign an International Chemical Weapons Convention, which it hasn't signed. Oh, also, Vladimir Putin is now writing op-eds for the New York Times. Before we get started in the discussion, let's listen to a bit of John Kerry's unscripted remark.
Sure, he could turn over every single bit of his chemical weapons to the international community in the next week. Turn it over, all of it. Without delay, and allow a full and total accounting before that. But he isn't about to do it, and it can't be done, obviously.
So as we record on Thursday, Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, Emily, would you pronounce that, please?
I hate you.
That's how I pronounce that.
Lavrov are meeting in Switzerland to discuss the details of a potential deal. From what we've seen so far, John, does it look like this is a deal that has a possibility of actually happening? Does it look like the Russians will come up with terms that would satisfy President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry?
By history, we should be skeptical. By the merits, we should be skeptical, but we don't really know what the merits of the deal are. But by the politics, there's a chance there will be a deal because the president was looking for an off-ramp. Everybody kept talking about the Syria situation having no good options. And this is actually a good option. And why is it a good option? Because the president was going to send over, 2,300-pound Tomahawk missiles to hit Syria, where 1,000 things could go wrong, to degrade Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons capability. This deal, if it happens, will completely remove, in theory, his chemical weapons capabilities and stockpiles. Now, that's a million miles away. It's a long, long way off. But that's a good outcome. Now, it's not a great outcome to the extent that one of the reasons Assad has jumped at this deal is that he basically hopes that, A, it elevates him as a kind of partner in these discussions. He's no longer Hitler. He's the guy we're trying to put a deal together. So that elevates him on the world stage. And he hopes that basically we'll forget, as I think the administration would like to, about the ongoing civil war that Assad is killing people using grisly conventional means, but that he'll be able to go back to that and retain power once this chemical weapons thing is kind of taken care of by this deal the Russians have brokered.
Back to rape and pillage. Emily, what's in it for Russia to do this deal?
Well, I think they also want to prevent a strike, right? I mean, that's not in their interest. Syria is their client state. They also, Putin made it really clear in his Time's op-ed, he does not want the United States wandering around the world with its missiles to put out the fires that it seeks to put out. And maybe chemical weapons really bother them. I mean, it's not like it's a good thing to have lots of chemical weapons rattling around in the world. So maybe the Russians also see a chance to do some good here. Is that too sunny and optimistic?
Russians love their children too.
I think they don't want it to the extent that they want. It's not necessarily that they want to do good. They want to keep bad from happening, which is to say that if Assad goes down and these rebels take control somehow of the country, you know, these are al-Qaeda Islamist types. And so if it's true what the experts say, which is that Putin doesn't want a kind of Chechnya in Syria, which is Islamists with some kind of access to chemical weapons. So that kind of instability of chemical weapons, he doesn't like that kind of a picture. So that's more of a sort of the realism case for him not wanting chemical weapons. I mean, look at what he's been able to do. He's basically saving President Obama's bacon. I mean, he's totally saving him. And he enjoys that. That's why he could write that incredibly obnoxious New York Times op-ed and preachy. He's just like pawning the president and he's loving it. So there's that part. And I think he wants to halt and curtail U.S. aims in the region, which he thinks might be rapacious. And, you know, he might think basically the U.S. wants its own client state in Syria. And so if he can wall off military action through a U.N. resolution, and that was the deal he said would offer. In other words, Assad gets rid of his chemical weapons if the U.S. drops its threat of violence. And now Assad has added another condition, which is why this is slippery and might fall apart. And Assad has basically said, okay, well, then stop arming the guys who are trying to kill me. Again, going to Assad's hope here, which is that if he takes care of the chemical weapons part, he can go back to winning the civil war, which he was doing. That would be made easier if the U.S. isn't helping the guys fighting against him.
John, how do the folks in the White House feel about the fact that Putin has come in to rescue them from a constitutional and political crisis?
I think, you know, they're irritated, but they would, you know, they were facing
will
a real kick in the pants. I think so. I mean, I don't find any... Look, the position, if you were playing by normal rules, would be vast skepticism about A, Assad, and B, Putin. Assad just, like, there is this chemical weapons attack which they believe absolutely his regime was involved in. And then he gave a 30-minute interview with Charlie Rose in which he repeatedly not only said he had nothing to do with the attack, he said he had no chemical weapons at all and did it with, you know, a straight face and with total gusto and all of that kind of eerie, icy one lie upon the other, at least as far as the administration sees what he's doing. In other words, they have every reason to distrust Assad and Putin. And so all things being equal, they would normally say this is a total trick. It's a total bluff. It's complete BS. That's not the way they're treating this. They're saying, well, we're skeptical. But the president has asked Congress to stop the vote. He's skeptical, but he's banking a lot on it. And obviously it was smart for him to stop the vote because from the minute he asked Congress to vote on this, he started leaking support. And by the time this deal was announced, it goes from leaking to like a gusher. I mean, and I was talking to members who had been brought into the Situation Room, who talked to the president, who talked to John Kerry, who talked to the vice president after all of that work. And then they said, no, the case isn't here. So he was losing in every possible way. So rather than be dealt that bad defeat, this is a good, you know, outcome for him.
So, Emily, you made the case in Slate this week. It was a bold move that this was a vindication of law, that if this deal goes through, it's a vindication of the norms of the law. Why is that?
Well, three reasons. I mean, first of all, it's a big victory if Syria signs the Chemical Weapons Convention and really disavows the use of chemical weapons. That would be really good for that law. Then there is the fact that the UN Charter, which created the Security Council apparatus and its sclerotic veto, would have been respected in this case. So if you buy the argument that a lot of international law...
What do you mean?
Do that again.
What are you saying?
Imagine this all works out. Syria backs down, hands over enough of its weapons, or they get secured in some way that the United States doesn't strike them over this and everybody goes home, sort of. So then instead of having a world in which the president makes up a really thin legal rationale based on American constitutional law and has no legal standing at all in international law to strike Syria, that all of that doesn't happen. And suddenly this yet another time breaching of the UN Charter and its rules for when countries use force against other countries doesn't happen. So that would be a victory for the whole international system that we've set up to keep the peace, at least relatively speaking, since World War II. That's the UN Charter, 1945.
Well, hold on. She's got number three
right,
to
number
go.
Number three. Do number three.
And then there's the constitutional law gain, which is that instead of yet another example of executive war making over the head of Congress, or even potentially like in direct conflict with Congress this time, that also wouldn't happen. That's my number three.
I mean, the UN one seems pretty non-persuasive in the sense that the UN is not vindicated at all. The UN has been sidestepped because everyone knows that the UN is incapable of having a role in this and that the UN has been vitiated by the refusal of the United States, Russia, and China primarily to treat it as anything but a pawn for their own national interests.
Completely disagree. Russia threatens a veto, gets the United States to back down, brokers a deal with Syria that gets rid of chemical weapons. How is that not a victory for the UN Charter and the whole way in which international law and norms are supposed to govern the use of force by one country against another country?
We don't have the UN, Emily. That's not what we have. What we have is powerful nations that occasionally have an incentive to act in collective interest, you know, whether it's to appease domestic politics, whether it's to help an ally, so that this deal gets done because Russia sees something in its national interest to get something done. That's why it's getting done. It has nothing at all to do with anything.
Well, what if you tried it this way? Hold on. What if it
does international law? Nothing.
Does this analogy hold? So I have a bomb in my house, and through the laws and the legislature and the collective action of the state, we've all decided that having a bomb in your house is a bad idea. I'm not giving up my bomb. And the police come to the door and they point a gun at my face and say, "We will shoot you in the face if you don't give up your bomb." And I say, "You know what? I'm going to give up my bomb." Now, did I give up the bomb because of the collective action of everybody that put together a law that said you're not allowed to have a bomb, or did I do it because there was a gun in my face?
The reason the cops came to your door is because there was a law against having the bomb in your house. And the reason that Putin gets to put Obama through his paces is that we have rules against when countries use force. And when Obama tried to use force with this made up, hugely broad rationale of, well, an American important interest is at stake and that's enough, nobody bought it. It didn't work domestically and it didn't work abroad. And the fact that there are those rules
has some bearing on this argument. I agree with you if you're talking about a chemical weapons convention. Yes.
What about the rules of the use of force? You think they're totally irrelevant, they mean absolutely nothing and had no bearing on this?
No, because is this going to change Assad's behavior towards his own people? Is the actual level of violence in Syria going to change at all? No.
That's not what we're arguing.
That's not what we're arguing. But the point is that Obama's hand wasn't stayed by the UN or any other agreements. His hand was stayed because he had no domestic support for an attack and he got an exit ramp that allowed him to not have to do the attack. And an outcome that in the end, if all these great, wonderful things happen, an outcome that is actually better than the one he would have gotten if he'd thrown the missiles. But that outcome is better not because of the UN or international law, but the outcome is better because he threatened to throw the missiles, in part. I think the outcome is also better because the Russians saw it in their interest and Assad.
No, I get to have last word. Just back up one step. Britain did not go for this. Obama thought it would. Britain did not go for this, nor have most of our allies. Why? Because Obama was violating the rules for the use of force. And that helped get the ball rolling. I'm just saying it has some relevance. That's all.
But, I mean, they didn't go for it in Britain, or for the same reason they didn't go for it in the States, which is it's not the laws. It's that they were about to launch and open a new war in the Middle East, and people are sick of those.
But the laws reflect the fact that we didn't have a coherent, good enough justification for going in. There was actually like a very nice dovetail.
Let's stop here. We can.
Because you're losing.
No. I could go on with this fight forever, but Volo is like sending me signals, like swirling his arm massively. Uh-huh. Like, stop talking.
Volo, bailing you out.
Oh, my God. I would happily argue about this. We can argue about this next week. I just think perhaps our listeners are tired of listening to you talk.
And you might be a stand-in for them. Just maybe.
Okay. Coming up, New York City's mayoral primary and the legacy of Michael Bloomberg. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Bill de Blasio, the most liberal Democrat in the race for New York mayor, won the primary there with relative ease this week and seemingly, although it's not certain yet, with enough votes to avoid a runoff with second-place finisher Bill Thompson. De Blasio's victory, along with a defeat of two Bloomberg-backed candidates in a Colorado recall election over guns. Those three events are seen as slaps at Mayor Bloomberg, at perhaps a sense that his star has fallen. De Blasio campaigned in New York, of course, against the idea that there were two cities, one for the very, very rich and the other for everybody else, who were, and that only the city for the very, very rich was doing well. He wants to tax the super rich to pay for education. He wants to end the stop and frisk policies that have annoyed so many people in that city and that are perceived as racial profiling by many. And he made his biracial family front and center of his campaign. He will face Joe Loda, Giuliani acolyte, in the general election. Democrats are 6-1 majority in the, at least among voter registrations in New York, and I think people think de Blasio is probably the strong favorite to win that election. We are not New Yorkers, but I certainly have watched the New York experiment under Giuliani and Bloomberg with great interest over the past 20 years. The city has gotten incredibly rich. Crime has dropped in remarkable ways. It's dropped to levels that no one thought would be possible 20 years ago. And yet, at the same time, it has huge inequality. There's this problem of racial profiling and the sense among minorities, particularly young minority men, that the city is not welcoming to them. Emily, is it your sense that this election is a repudiation of Bloombergism, of his kind of patriarchal, nanny state, wealth-favoring, elitist, technocratic government?
Well, it's not a direct rejection of him, right? Because it does matter that he was on the ballot. But don't you think it's like the classic pivot where a city or a state, whatever, moves in a certain direction with a leader who does some things incredibly well, but of course has flaws, because all leaders do. And then that leader plays out his or her hand over time, and some things go well, but gradually the excesses build up. In Bloomberg's case, I think the stop and frisk policy is the best example. And Bloomberg also made that classic mistake where he didn't back down off of stop and frisk. When it was clearly becoming more and more controversial, he doubled down instead of saying, hey, wait, maybe my critics have a point to make here. And so now, faced with this other choice and a kind of not that appealing candidate in Christine Quinn, she didn't catch fire in that kind of personal charisma way that voters want. They moved on to a different vision and are starting to think about the critique about inequality and this like tale of two cities line that de Blasio was really successful in putting forward.
Quinn felt like the kind of George Herbert Walker Bush to Ronald Reagan. I mean, the kind of caretaker of the previous administration candidate. And Thompson, who was should have had a knocked de Blasio's chances out in the African-American community, didn't do as well there as he could have. And you know, de Blasio ran a great and smart race on like a shoestring, too, which it turned out that shoestring ended up kind of nicely matching this anti-Bloomberg message. You remember Bloomberg's apartment was in, I don't know, it was Vogue or Vanity Fair. But I mean, it was just this like encrusted, gilded, vast array of rooms. And de Blasio's kitchen was so small they couldn't film the famous ad in the campaign that was narrated by his son, his biracial son. They couldn't even film it in their own kitchen. It was so small. So if you're going to run against Bloomberg, it sort of matches in lots of different ways.
What do you guys make of this point that Bloomberg has emphasized in the closing week of the campaign, where he said, you know, de Blasio's criticisms of the rich are really misplaced, that we should want every Russian billionaire to move to New York City. It's the super wealthy who are financing and all the things that are making this city so wonderful. Is there a different? I think we can agree generally that the rampant inequality that's affected America has all sorts of baleful effects. Probably all three of us agree on that. Is it also true at an urban level that this kind of inequality is damaging? In particular, is it bad to have a lot of really, really, really wealthy people, or a number of really, really, really wealthy people who kind of anchor your city and spur development?
Well, Bloomberg's argument is that let's bring them more, like have all the Russian oligarch billionaires move in, because these are the people who are supporting the tax base that pays for all the services that the poorer people are getting. I think, though, that he is tone deaf to what it feels like to be poor or even middle class in a city where there are these people who are so incredibly wealthy. You know, when you look at happiness research, how people feel about their own economic circumstances has everything to do with what the people around them are capable of buying. And I've never lived in New York, but I'd imagine that you could feel kind of not poor, but like as if you didn't have enough all the time because everyone is, or not everyone, but it would feel like lots of other people are lavishly spending money. And so your perfectly reasonable or maybe not quite enough income would feel paltry and cramped. Your life would feel cramped in comparison, maybe.
Yeah.
What Bloomberg was saying, and I don't know how you get the balance right and don't know enough about New York, but his argument was like, I have to cater to Wall Street because that's the business in town. I mean, at some level, he's right in that he needs Wall Street to thrive for New York to thrive. You could imagine having lots and lots of wealthy people in New York if the gap between the two in services and feeling and access to education and health and safe housing wasn't so vast. It's not that there are wealthy people there. It's that the people at the lower end haven't risen high enough.
Right. I think that's true. Although I guess if I were Bloomberg, I would say, while it's certainly true he has made it safer to be really rich in New York and allowed all sorts of, you know, building that helps the really rich and everyone gets a town car and all that, I think he would say that the government that he's presided over has won. It has reduced the number one threat to poor people, crime. So, right. So that you're safer. So you do not have to worry as much about your child. He's made efforts in education that were profound efforts in education. They haven't worked out very well, but you can't fault him for not trying. He has put parks in everywhere, all over the city. And then he's launched these very ambitious kind of nanny state efforts about smoking, so improving public health, improving people's diet. And while both of your point about, you know, that envy and the fact that it's stressful to live in a world where you can't afford anything, I think this other progressive work that he's done is incredibly admirable and great, and we're going to miss it. Like, he's a very creative kind of mayor. I suspect that when we look back from 20 or 40 years hence, people will say this was the progressive era. We're in the progressive era, and Michael Bloomberg is basically the Teddy Roosevelt of our time, that he is the person who is coming up with the most creative, implementing the most creative kinds of progressive ideas, and that regular people, everyday people are going to benefit from those over the long term.
I agree with a lot of that in terms of all the policy choices, and I've defended things like the soda ban. But I also think that Bloomberg doesn't – you use the word nanny state. It feels very top down. It feels like he is telling you what is good for you, right?
Totally.
Not that he has compassion. And so, you know, not surprisingly, when New Yorkers were asked about the quality they cared most about in the next mayor, they talked about someone who would understand what it was like to be them. They don't – you can feel like Bloomberg has the right prescriptions without feeling like he gets you.
Yes, but I guess it's nice for someone to be able to be elected who isn't always being empathic. Like, I hate – the empathy seems to me like a slightly overrated quality to have – to seek in politicians. Also, the nice thing about him not giving a rat's about what anyone thought for the most part and just being a super rich guy who could do whatever he wanted is that he engaged in a lot of long-term thinking. So New York has thought a lot about climate change. Bloomberg thinks about long-term public health issues, things that don't actually matter in the 4 or 8 or 12 years that he was mayor, things that will only pay off in the long term. It's the rare politician who has the ability to actually do that. Everyone says they want to engage in long-term thinking, but very few of them actually do it. And I think because he is built how he is, he was able to do that.
I think that's true. On the other hand, I do think it matters that he backed stop and frisk past the point where that was the right thing to do. You know, there was a lot of evidence that it was discriminating against African Americans. The city had all of those numbers long before the plaintiffs and the courts did. And instead of recognizing any of that and the reasons why people were frustrated and upset with the police force, Bloomberg just, you know, railed at the judge who called him on it.
Right. It's especially hypocritical because he is such a data hound. He's somebody who is so technocratic and data oriented, and for them to hide that data, mask that data, not let people get access to that data was particularly disingenuous.
And, you know, for him to call Bill de Blasio racist this week for putting up this ad of his son Dante and appealing to people on the basis of race, I mean, I think that was essentially what Bloomberg was trying to say, was something about pandering. It was really crass, and it made me think that he has a blind spot about race, or maybe he's just angry that people are mad at him about stop and frisk. I hadn't quite seen that side of him before in that way, and I'm glad that he mostly was able to mask it while he was mayor. Or maybe I'm being, you know, it was just a slip-up and I'm being unfair a bit.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, the new documentary film Salinger. And then, what happened to the idea of popularity? You'd think it'd be a pretty simple, straightforward one. Well, it's not anymore. We'll discuss with Adam Sternberg, the culture editor of the New York Times Magazine. And finally, The Onion. Some say it's our best op-ed page. Others say it has lost its wit. Joining me is Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
Salinger is the new documentary feature film about the writer, J.D. Salinger. It's directed by Shane Salerno, and it tells the story of Salinger's privileged childhood. His wartime experiences, which are remarkable, included storming the beaches of Normandy and liberating the death camp Dachau, and his rise to fame and a subsequent notorious retreat to the hills of New Hampshire. Dana, I am very anxious to hear what you thought of this movie, but first, why don't we listen to a clip from it?
To be on the cover of Time magazine in 1961 was something that only went to statesmen and Nobel laureates.
You owe us another book. I mean, after all, we rewarded you with fame, with money. We said you're one of the important writers of the century. Now, come on, let's have some more.
All right, Dan, I have not read your review, but I am very curious to know what you made of this film.
Yeah, I'm very curious to talk with you guys about it. To me, this film felt like such a sad lost opportunity because I think anyone who's a Salinger fan who's just interested in this reclusive literary figure who's one of the great mysteries of kind of 20th century American fiction was really eager to see this documentary, to see the supposed new 5 minutes of revelations that have been so heavily touted by the Weinstein Company campaign on all the buses everywhere in town. And then you see the movie, and I was just staggered at how terrible it was, in what terrible taste it was made, just sort of what an assault on the viewer's senses it is. And yes, there's a little bit of new information about the author, but boy, do you have to grit your teeth and sit through some terrible, terrible filmmaking and very loud music and just kind of general, I don't even know what to call it, just loudly trumpeted vulgarity in order to get to those facts. And then when they do come, my impression is that they're somewhat dubiously sourced. For example, the big claim at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, although this has already appeared in the press long before the movie even opened, that there are these supposed new works of J.D. Salinger coming out, that his trust has okayed the publication of, I think, 5 new books. It's 2 anonymous sources who told the filmmaker this, and it seems like the whole film is hanging on this big revelation that may turn out not even to be true.
Right. Julia, what did you think? Was this basically just a blast of vulgarity tastelessly delivered?
This was the single worst movie I've ever seen in my life. It is almost worth seeing to see how bad something can be. Mm. Like, it was almost artfully bad. I mean, the elements of it that are horrible are manifold, but let me enumerate a few. Number one, it includes as experts on J.D. Salinger a series of actors who seem to have no qualification to talk about the importance of J.D. Salinger other than being vaguely famous actors. Martin Sheen is quoted at length about the legacy of J.D. Salinger. Edward Norton reads excerpts of Salinger letters. Philip Seymour Hoffman talks with, you know, like, who gives a shit what Philip Seymour Hoffman thinks about J.D. Salinger? I'm sure he's a very smart guy, but who cares? The film is shot throughout with ludicrously laughable reenactments in which a sort of Salinger-esque dude totes a log around New Hampshire, spends a lot of time typing at a typewriter in a darkened theater while images from his life are projected on a screen behind him. When he learns, for example, that a story has been rejected by The New Yorker, he shoves all the papers off the table in a theatrical gesture. I mean, it is just laughable. I mean, people in the theater were just laughing out loud. And then I think the film just has incredibly bad taste, for lack of a better word. I mean, it tries to reckon with J.D. Salinger's experience during war, which I didn't know that much about and which was extensive and remarkable, and he really was there for a number of key moments. But in doing so, it, I thought, particularly tastelessly, you know, focuses on how he was there to liberate Dachau and how part of what they found at Dachau were a number of corpses and people who had been burned alive. And you see incredibly gruesome footage of this. And then the filmmakers just reuse this footage, these gruesome death camp photos of burned bodies as this, like, peppy shorthand throughout the rest of the movie. Wherever they're talking about Salinger and the horrors of war, they'll just, like, throw a few more emaciated corpses up there. And it's like, no, you can't. If you're going to use images that powerful, you have to use them with care, not just as, like, shorthand representations of how crippled his psyche was after the war. It was morally disgusting, aesthetically laughable, the worst movie I've ever seen.
Right, and I'll make...
Wow, I love that takedown, Julia. That was so good.
All right, well, I'll make the howlingly obvious comment, which is that, I mean, you could have made this movie using almost all the exact same raw materials and done quite a good film.
That's what I mean about it being such a lost
Absolutely.
Opportunity. I mean, a lot of research was put into it. This guy, Shane Salerno, has been making this movie and the companion volume of the sort of oral biography that he compiled with David Shields for 10 years.
Yeah.
And he gets a lot of new information and footage.
A ton of stuff. And some of it, you can argue where the line between privacy and revelation should be drawn, especially for someone like Salinger. Right? You could also argue the more complex argument, which you've started to, want to hear, which is that, you know, this is a real peekaboo act on the part of J.D. Salinger. In fact, what it did was draw an immense amount of attention that he wouldn't otherwise have gotten to him. It might have been a function of his own narcissism, which is on display in his portrayals, creation and betrayals of the Glass family and its relationships with vastly younger women. All of these are complex, interesting arguments that could have been in a nuanced film about who J.D. Salinger was and what the significance of his silence was. The other irony of this is you don't need to hype J.D. Salinger. I mean, it's first of all, everyone walking into that theater has probably read The Catcher in the Rye as they ram up our nostrils several times. It's sold something like 60 million copies. It needs to be immediately described in terms more appropriate to the Da Vinci Code. There's no need for this kind of breathlessness that assumes that no one will be interested in the subject unless you make him sound like Dan Brown. It's crazy. To which I would add just very briefly, the most interesting thing I've read recently about J.D. Salinger was in the New York Times a few years ago, indicating, in fact, that his popularity is waning very rapidly, in part because he writes about a tiny slice of the world which has really disappeared. And now when you try to introduce Catcher in the Rye to young audiences, they find him whiny and overprivileged. Now, I don't think this is about J.D. Salinger, but it's an interesting and challenging thought. Came nowhere near this movie.
Yeah, there's no attempt at all to place him in any kind of context, contemporary context, to sort of, you know, talk about the history of his reception.
Yeah, the movie makes no attempt whatsoever to place the book or any of the works in literary context, to do any kind of sophisticated literary criticism. It essentially argues that J.D. Salinger and Holden Caulfield are one and the same. It also seems to endorse basically Mark David Chapman, the John Lennon assassin's reading of The Catcher in the Rye, and essentially say, like, yeah, the world is full of phonies, and you know, the torment of war caused Salinger to react to the horrors of American society, and, you know, so no wonder people went out and assassinated or tried to assassinate people after reading the book. I mean, it was disgusting.
It didn't end with the death of John Lennon, and that's, you know, you keep paying for this over and over when you hear of a death of a celebrity, and maybe they've got The Catcher in the Rye, as John Hinckley did.
Young Hinckley, the whiz kid who shot Reagan and his press secretary, said, if you want my defense, all you have to do is read Catcher in the Rye.
That segment on the assassinations was, to me, probably the most reprehensible part, along with the use of the Dachau clips that you mentioned, which are among the things that flash up behind Mr. Logtote when he's on stage typing away at his typewriter. But yeah, this affirmation or vindication of the idea that Catcher in the Rye is some kind of manual for assassins, it just seemed like an excuse, essentially, to revisit some really current affair-esque tabloid footage of John Lennon's assassination and the attempted Reagan assassination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, if you dare, go see this movie and tell us what you think about it. Maybe you won't revile it with quite the intensity we did. It's called Salinger, and it's in limited release now. It'll be out more widely soon.
You totally will revile it. Don't believe Steve. If you go see it, you will revile it.
And if you don't, we revile you. Coming up, after 25 years, is the satirical news site The Onion at the top of its game or past its prime? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we talk about on the program, we collect them at our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. Be honest. Excoriate away. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. Popularity used to be simple. We had the chart-topping song, the top-rated TV show, the number one bestseller, the highest-grossing movie of the year. So writes Adam Sternberg, the culture editor of the New York Times Magazine. And he goes on to say, now the concept of cultural popularity has been flayed hung by its heels and drained of all meaning. We are thrilled and honored to have Adam Sternberg on the show for the first time. Adam, I've been a fan of your work for a really, really, really long time. It's awesome to have you here to talk about this piece.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
All right. Well, tell us what was popularity before it flayed and frayed and got confusing and ambivalent. What was it and how did it and why did it change?
Well, I think the best example is probably the Billboard music charts. And when I went back and looked at the history of the Billboard music charts, it really did literally start as a single chart that recorded a single piece of information, which was sales. And then over the years, it kind of evolved to incorporate new information and new technology, as well as splitting off into a bunch of different kind of charts that represented different genres. And now it has, I think, to a certain extent, been overwhelmed by this job of trying to chart popularity of music, because the way we experience music has changed so much. And I think that's true across the board. You know, I think it's true in television. I mean, just today I was having a back and forth with one of the producers of one of the shows that I mentioned in the article about what the actual ratings of the show are, because we had reported a number, but then they were saying, well, people watch it and when it's rebroadcast, and then there's DVRs, and you didn't count streams. And so all of these numbers, suddenly we have so many numbers, but it's really hard to kind of figure out which one of them is actually meaningful.
Okay, so there's first of all, there's the salamiing down of the audience right into niche groups. So there's no longer, you no longer aggregate in this mega way. You know, final episode of MASH gets 125 million viewers. There's just nothing could ever approach that. And the second thing then maybe is even more subtle and complex, right, which is that there's kind of the raw numbers, and there are still things that break through in the millions or tens of millions, right? And then there's kind of the cultural consciousness. And in a way, what I found most provocative about your piece is that these two things have separated out. So Girls, which is undoubtedly the show that you were talking to the producer of, Guilty Smile, its audience is estimated to be in the kind of incredible six figures, right? I mean, incredibly low relative to the coverage that it gets, whereas the consciousness of the culture is created by editors who lap it up and watch it avidly and think about it all the time. And somewhat similarly, Mad Men, right, which, you know, you can't swing an axe without seeing another Slate piece about Mad Men during its season, and yet it's watched by a comparative... Sorry. That was for you, Julia Turner.
I know.
But it's watched by a comparatively small number of people compared to even Walking Dead.
Yeah, and network TV has always been about numbers and really about eyeballs, and that was always the kind of complaint about it, was this, that it had to appeal to the widest possible audience. Now that you have cable, and now even beyond cable, you have Netflix with their kind of strange voodoo metrics that they don't, you know, ever reveal to anyone... There's all these new considerations about what makes a show successful. Was House of Cards successful for Netflix? Was it even popular? It's actually kind of hard to know. I mean, certainly people talked about it for a moment, and it rearranged the way we think about Netflix, so I have to imagine it was successful for them. But in terms of, you know, what's the most popular TV show right now, you could have 100 people give you maybe not 100 different answers, but like at least 20.
Yeah, that's one question I had for you, Adam. So I really enjoyed the package in the Times Magazine about popularity, and one of the arguments you make in it is that the fragmentation of what's popular is probably a good thing for culture overall, because it allows more different types of culture to flourish. Each one can find its own niche audience. That is a wonderful thing. I think I probably agree with you that that's a wonderful thing, that you don't necessarily have to appeal to everybody in the entire country in order to be, quote, popular. But I also wonder whether then popularity becomes something of a meaningless construct. Like, is something still popular if it's only popular to an each group? You know, apart from people like the people in this room who are either culture editors or culture critics or people who like to talk about what's popular and what it means and why, if something is not, in fact, popular to a mass number of people, it is not being experienced by most of the culture, apart from the chattering classes who natter on about it. So does fragmented popularity matter to anyone other than people who sit around and talk about culture and critique it?
Well, I think it depends on what you use popularity for. You know, when I was working on the piece and sort of thinking, yeah, we're all in our little niches now and we all listen to our own, you know, playlists and watch our own shows. And I, to me, that at first glance feels like we've lost something. We don't all sort of participate together in the same way we did, although certainly I think there's many counterexamples of everyone talking. I mean, look at what's happening with Breaking Bad right now. It literally feels like every single person that I've ever met in my life is talking about Breaking Bad. But if you think of popularity as a kind of pointer, a sort of like a, you know, a dowser stick to point you towards some, like a little gusher of creativity, the more things that are popular by some metric, the more little flags there's going to be all over the culture that, you know, direct, that catch your attention. So if the number one song in America is a song that I can't stand, or, you know, we have a song in the package, that Black Eyed Peas song, I Got a Feeling, which is the most downloaded song of all time, I don't think there's going to be that many people who are going to be like, huh, and then go listen to it and then fall in love with it. But if you then look at the sort of subcategories and say, oh, well, this is the most streamed song, or this is the most illegally downloaded song, like, it just creates a universe of popularity with more constellations in it that are going to catch your attention.
Adam, I want to know, what were some of the surprises that you and the writers to whom you assigned these little mini pieces on the most popular movie, the most popular download, et cetera, what were the surprises that you came across, things that you had either never heard of or thought were a very kind of small part of pop culture that turned out to be number one in their category?
Well, the big one was this podcast called Welcome to Night Vale.
You had to start with the podcast.
Well, it's funny because the kind of dilemma that we faced when we started working on the package was that it would just be a big package full of no duh moments, right? Like, oh, Taylor Swift, she's really popular, duh, or the Black Eyed Peas, you know. But that podcast, Welcome to Night Vale, as it turns out, is at this moment, through a weird circumstance, the most downloaded podcast on iTunes. And certainly that surprised all of us. And none, I don't think any of the people working on it had ever heard of it or listened to it. And a bunch of people have now and sort of become converts. But,
and it's kind of a noirish podcast about a fictional town. Is that right?
It is a very weird podcast. I mean, that's what's sort of encouraging about it, is that anyone who thinks about popularity as, you know, scarlet letter of mediocrity or something like that, this podcast is like a complete repudiation of that, because it is a very odd podcast and has a very distinct sort of sensibility to it. And I think sometimes as culture critics, I'm certainly guilty of this idea that, like, everything good gets overlooked and everything bad and bland gets celebrated and pushed to the forefront. But there's so many obvious counterexamples to that.
So the culture package is called The Wisdom and Whimsy of the Crowd: What Does It Mean to Be Popular Now? It was edited by and introduced by Adam Sternberg, the culture editor of The New York Times Magazine. Adam, a huge pleasure. I hope you come back.
Oh, thank you so much.
All right. Well, The Onion, of course, is the satirical newspaper which originated in Madison, Wisconsin years ago. It's just basically little more than a supermarket circular. Here we are 15-some-odd years later.
25
is the word I was searching for years later. And it's now a huge media phenomenon, and this makes it a large target, right? And therefore, even though it is still beloved by some people, it's also made it something of a target. So on the one hand, Julia Turner, you have Noreen Malone, ex-Slate writer now writing for The New Republic, proclaiming The Onion America's best op-ed page by a huge margin. On the other hand, you have Dave Weigel, now of Slate, claiming that The Onion has become incredibly overrated. In fact, it's a kind of hermetic opinion chamber speaking to liberals what they already believe. And somewhere in between the two of them is Farhad Manjoo, Slate's erstwhile technology columnist, who says a little bit of both. But Julia, what do you think about The Onion? Is it losing its edge? Can it really get this big and stay this big and still be this kind of knifing satirical presence in American life?
Well, I think what all three of those pieces were responding to was actually a slight change in the tone of The Onion over the past year. In particular, the newspaper has focused a fair amount of attention on the situation in Syria and the complete inability until recently of the American government or populace to seem to care at all about it or propose to do anything at all about it. Some of the headlines are, "Help has to be on the way now, thinks Syrian man currently being gassed. Obama deeply concerned after Syrians gassed to death on White House lawn." And, "Hi, in the past 2 years, you have allowed me to kill 70,000 people," by Bashar al-Assad. So, you know, that is one way to use humor to make a persistent political point. And The Onion seems to have been marshaling its comedic forces in favor of intervention. Of course, now that some kind of intervention is on the table, The Onion seems to be marshaling its forces the other direction. But I think Farhad Manjoo had, you know, kind of the most interesting investigation of this, which is trying to figure out why, in fact, the tone of The Onion has changed. And there's actually been some significant shifts in the way that the newspaper operates over the past year that has sort of changed the tone of the place. And the changes are briefly that The Onion's offices in New York were closed up. The staff was moved to Chicago. Some of them went, some of them did not. And with that move to Chicago came a focus on a digital strategy rather than the print strategy. So instead of producing 20 perfect pieces a week that they could slave over, they're now producing many pieces a day, which may mess with their batting average and may also bias them toward slightly more straightforward, less nuanced liberal takes of the sort that people want to pass around and share on Facebook.
Well, I was just going to say that when we proposed doing this topic, before I had read, you know, this sudden spate of arguments that The Onion was going downhill, I had just very recently been the person social mediaizing hilarious Onion articles to people. And one of them that I thought was not only very funny, but very dark, and an example of the really beautifully trenchant satire that The Onion can do, is this sort of neither liberal nor conservative op-ed about Israel and Palestine with the headline, "The Onion encourages Israel and Palestine not to give a single goddamn inch." And I really encourage everyone to go and read this. Actually, you'll be almost weeping by the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, they still produce amazing satire. Okay, so the one that I picked out that, I mean, again, it's just like weep-worthy for how funny it is. There's a color photo, like a real Kodak-style photo of a father, you know, with a receding hairline, kind of placing his hand gently on his, you know, five-year-old son's shoulder. And the headline is, "Father teaches son how to fly into rage over completely inconsequential bullshit." And then it's a long... It's so good. Oh, man, Pat, I got Pashman. And just to put too fine a point on it, I mean, I think the problem people now currently have with the... I mean, both The Daily Show and The Onion are brilliant. We should say that they're brilliantly written, they're brilliantly presented, you know. But if it, to the extent that they sometimes lose their core audience, it's because they lapse a little bit into stridency. And I think one reason is once... the thing that you're satirizing, television news, the nightly news, or you know, journalese, once those things become culturally recessive, right, your satire loses a little bit of edge, and what do you replace it with? You replace it with dudgeon, right? And suddenly you break character and you come out of it and you're like, this is genuinely outrageous, which is death to satire. And I think one of the reasons why Colbert is so triumphant now is that the right wing, you know, talking head ninny that he's satirizing is actually a current cultural force to be reckoned with, which is why Colbert never needs to break character.
So maybe what we need is not a show making fun of The Onion or making fun of The Daily Show, but we need some satirical cultural force whose entire point is to satirize the internet itself.
Well, but what about, how about someone whose cultural authority doesn't derive from satire? I mean, there is an absolute bumper crop of satire. There's nothing but satire in this culture. Look, watch 20 consecutive minutes of an NFL football game and watch the ads. There are people who are not quite as talented as the writers of The Daily Show and The Onion who are pretty funny and probably went to good colleges, and they sit around in a writer's room and they produce ads for Dunkin' Donuts. I mean, this sensibility is now absolutely everywhere, and there's no daring to it at all because there's no dominant cultural grain against which it cuts.
But weren't you just taking Jon Stewart down for his supposed over-earnestness? Steve paints self into corner.
Oh, Dana.
Chapter 14.
Yeah, you got me. Yeah.
I would like to see a phonetic rendering of that noise that you just made, Steve. That was awesome.
Okay, well, to wrap it up, those pieces are one by Farhad Manju on Slate, one by Dave Weigel on Slate, and then one by Noreen Malone in the New Republic magazine. It's available online. We'll link to them on our show page. All right, well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse Dana Stevens. What do you got?
All right. Well, it's fitting enough that we did popularity this week, because I'm afraid that this endorsement is such an obvious endorsement for this week that one of you may have planned it already for your endorsement. But
you're endorsing Katy Perry's Roar, too. I knew it, Dana.
Blast. No, my endorsement this week is the Elvis Costello, The Roots collaboration. Have you guys heard this yet? It's available streaming online, the album that's going to be released, I believe, next week. It's called Wise Up Ghost, and it's always exciting when Elvis Costello pairs with completely unexpected artists, like the Burt Bacharach collaboration that he did maybe 15 years ago or so, a great, great album. Now he's paired with The Roots, with Jimmy Fallon's house band, and the results are magnificent. I've only heard the album one time through, so I can't really speak to what song sticks out the most, but it's this very tight funk sound, almost like an old soul soundtrack or something, and it's just really great to hear Elvis Costello's familiar wailing voice over a completely different musical background. So I can't wait to get home and listen to some more Wise Up Ghost.
This is also quite obvious, but if you are not watching Breaking Bad, don't resist it. If you tried to watch the first season and found it too grim and unsettling, go back and pick up. Of all the premium TV crazes that there have been that we've ever talked about, I feel like Breaking Bad is the single most flawlessly executed bit of premium television ever. Just the perfection of the pacing, the marvelousness of the performances, its seeming inability to ever put a foot wrong. It's an incredibly impressive piece of work. So don't give up. There's like a few weeks left. You could catch up and watch the finale with the rest of the world and just be the Walter White.
It's too late for me. I haven't watched minute one of Breaking Bad. I mean, I'll watch it, but I'm never going to watch it in time to catch up with the finale.
That's fair, I guess.
I'm midway through season four.
At least I didn't need to worry about having the most obvious endorsement of the week. Like, no one on Slate has mentioned that Breaking Bad might be any good.
Damn. Dana's ripping us both up today, Steve.
I know. I'm going to endorse for the first time ever in 5 years of doing the show, I'm going to endorse a television show that's on right now. But it's on the BBC, so it's a snobby import. But it's the crime show Broadchurch. I don't know that I love it. This isn't, I'm not pounding the table. It's not like it's The Wire or Breaking Bad or whatever. But it's very good, and it definitely, what it does is it takes this little town. Here's its hook, right? It takes this little seaside town in England, which has a classic sort of town gown situation in that it's seasonal, right? So it's all the city folk and the tourists come in season, and then it evacuates completely, leaving these locals sort of staring at one another. And they have these decades-long dramas playing out with one another, and one of their children washes up in the surf dead, and these detectives have to come and solve the crime. Good episodes are masterful and wonderful and almost hit prime suspect-like heights of television drama. But it's midway through, so it's to be determined. But I like it, and I'd love to hear it from listeners if they've been watching, if they like it too. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Dan Pashman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week. Let's kick it off. I know the will.